Hi, my name's Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic, and happy to be here. I consider it an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I didn't always feel that way. I have a sobriety date, which is July 22nd of 2005. I have a home group, which is the Midtown group, and Chris, who just spoke, is my sponsor. And none of those things have changed since July 22nd of 2005, which is unusual for me because I like to change things regularly. I like to move a lot. I like to run away, give me a new state, maybe a new social security number, you know, things like that. You know, I'm going to try and talk a little bit about being an alcoholic, about my drinking, you know, and kind of what happened and what, you know, what it's like now. I was born in Washington State, you know, farming and logging community. People worked really hard and they partied. They drank, they went to the tavern on Friday and Saturday night. And you know, I hear a lot of people talk in AA and they say, you know, I was really good at sports until, or I was really good in school and then I started, you know, messing up. And I was never really good at anything except for like drinking. I loved it. When I was 5 years old, I remember being on the tailgate of a brand new 1970 Ford F-150 with a keg, you know, filling up everyone's cup for them, and I would, like, eat the foam off. Now, I wasn't an alcoholic then, but I just loved it. I felt comfortable being the center of attention, and I think I woke up later with, like, my pants missing, which was kind of a theme for my life, and, you know, nothing bad happened or anything. You know, fast forward, like, I was the youngest, so I had these older brothers who taught me a lot of things that I needed to know in life, like how to smoke, how to lie, how to sneak, you know, their stuff in and out of my parents' house, you know, and those kinds of things. And when I was 11, my mom and dad got divorced, and mom and I moved away to the big city, which had, you know, it was Olympia, Washington. It had like 30,000 people. It wasn't that big, but it was huge to me. And, you know, if I'm honest now, looking back, I can say I was terrified because I grew up with these older brothers that always kind of protected me, and I had a reputation I didn't earn. I had their reputation, you know, and people didn't mess with me, and now I was all alone, you know, in this city. And I'd learned, you know, about how to buy food, and I'd learned, you know, that if I asked enough people, someone would buy me food. And, you know, and I was like 11, 12. And I drank a lot after school, before school. No one ever, like, people talk about, oh, I never drank in the morning. I didn't know that that was a bad idea. I thought it was a great idea. Like, why wouldn't you drink in the morning? It's a great way to start your day, you know? And drinking alone, just, it was like, you know, watching a really good movie, only you didn't have to have a TV. You know, things were just entertaining. And, you know, fast forward to my early 20s, I got in a lot of trouble. I didn't do good in school. I was asked to leave the entire school district in Olympia, Washington, and never come back, you know, and I was fine with that. And, you know, I got like one credit in high school. It was wood shop, because I helped build, you know, furniture for the wood shop teacher, so he gave me a credit, you know, they suspended me. And that was it, you know, and I didn't care. I left school, I ran away a lot, I found women who, you know, had children in welfare and a place to stay, and I shacked up with them, and that's kind of how I survived, you know. I was kind of just a scumbag, you know. I kind of ran away to the trailer park, really, is what I did. And I liked it there, it was fun, because you could do whatever you wanted, no one cared. So fast forward, you know, I kind of cleaned myself up around 18, 19, I got my best friend's ex-girlfriend pregnant, so I ended up marrying her. You know, like I said, I'm kind of a scumbag, and I would have never admitted that. Like, you know, we just went, it wasn't my fault. It just happened, like, it's her idea, right? And, you know, I remember, like, I kind of woke up one time with, like, something hit me in the head, and it was a bottle of, like, dish soap that she had thrown at me, and she was yelling at me. Pregnant, I get married and have a family, I'll probably straighten up. Like, things will be better, right? And so I did, and it didn't work. Fast forward a few years later, you know, her and I are off and on, and my son was born. And before my son was born, I had what I like to, what I always thought was just a run of bad luck. I got like a DWI in January, one in like the end of February, June, August, September. I think I had five by the time September rolled around, which is a lot. Like, they were for sure targeting me, even though I switched cars a few times. Like, they were watching for me personally. I was sure of it. Because I drank and drove all those years before, and nothing ever happened. But so I got this lawyer. Back then, we had phone books, and there was advertisements in the back of the phone book, and there was, like, this guy's face, and it said, Jay Fuller, DWI. And so I called Jay. He became my lawyer. And, you know, he had this scam worked out where he could wrap all these things into one charge, and all I had to do was give him $500, the court's $500, and go to these classes for 2 years. And I thought, that, I can do that. And they're like, oh, you can't drink, there's two drugs. And I was like, that's probably okay, right? And I tried to stop, and I did stop, but I felt horrible. It was awful. I started going to these classes, and I was scared about, I didn't want to go to jail for a long time or anything. And I'm going to these classes, and I think I'm sober. I found out later that if you drink a bottle of, like, Vicks 44 every night before you go to bed, you're not actually sober. Like, I didn't know that. I thought I was sober. But I needed it because I had had a cough, a little cough, you know, a lot. And I went to these classes, and I didn't drink for a while, like a month or so. And, you know, I thought I this was all right, but, like, one weekend I decided, well, you know, my mind just kind of changed, and I was like, I can drink, you know, on the weekend, and no one will probably know, and I tried it, and it worked out really well. It worked out so well that I just continued to drink every night after the class, and, you know, like, 2 months later, I remember I'd moved in with that wife, you know, because I was sober and doing so well and all that stuff, and, I mean, she was just so irritating. It was Saturday, which was my Friday. I had Sunday and Monday off, and I started a fight with her because I wanted to leave and drink. Because that's what you do. You, like, create some trauma so that you can go away and do what you want. And that's what I did. And then the next thing I know is I wake up, and I'm not sure where it is, but I realize I just hit something with my truck. And I'm like, you know, I don't know what's going on. Slowly, I come out of it. I come out of this blackout, and I hit this lady head-on in my truck, in her little car, and it terrified me. And I went to the hospital, and you know, I was scared to death that I was going to kill someone, and I was also scared of going to prison. So I didn't. I wouldn't talk to anyone. I just called the lawyer, and he said, "Don't talk to anyone. You're going straight to treatment." And I did that stuff, and I went to a 28-day treatment, and they taught me about, you know, alcoholism, kind of. They brought AA meetings in there. It was my first real exposure to AA, and it was really weird. This, like, logger guy came. He'd been sober for, like, 8 months. He smoked, like, 10 cigarettes during the hour, because I counted them. So that's what I do. I just sit and judge people. And, you know, sat on the edge of his seat, and he shook around a lot, and talked about, you know, I run up and down mountains, and I don't drink anymore, and my life is really great. And I was like, that's crazy. And, I also learned, I learned the Serenity Prayer, because I didn't know that before going to treatment. And I learned that if, when group started, if I just, like, nonchalantly asked the question about, well, what about smoking, the two counselors would start arguing, and then the group would be over. And that was always kind of entertaining. So that's kind of what I did in treatment. But I swore I'm not going to drink anymore, like, no matter what, because I don't want to kill anyone. And I know when I drink, I don't know what's going to happen. I drive. So fast forward a few years, you know, it's Jerry not drinking. Just not a very nice person. But, like, I'm succeeding in my eyes in life. I've paid my bills. I've gotten rid of the ex-wife. I got a new girlfriend, you know, kind of upgraded. I'm doing well at work. I'm a sous chef at this restaurant. I'm only 22, you know, I'm scheduling all these level, which is what I know now looking back to other people. And I was so wound up and I couldn't stop. I couldn't sit still ever. I remember one time I had a couple of days off and I just freaked out. Like, I didn't know what to do because I worked all the time and I took care of my kids and I did all this stuff, you know. And I got custody of my kids too. And, you know, things like, I was just so miserable. And again, I got a cough. I like to get a cough, a little bronchitis. I smoked a lot, you know. So I got a little codeine cough syrup, you know, and that felt kind of good. So I started getting different doctors, and I had a lot of codeine cough syrup. And then my knee hurt, and I needed pain medicine. And one day I was like, I'm going to drink. I like to drink, right? And it was 1:30 in the afternoon, and I drank. And, you know, everyone knew I was sober, right? And at 4:30, like, my mom, my ex-wife, second ex-wife, my sister, like a bunch of people are at my house and they're really freaking mad and they all know that I drink. And it's like, well, I can't drink anymore. You know, because everyone knows right away. And I'm very much a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but for a period of time, I used drugs after that in an alcoholic fashion. And, you know, I gained all these things. Like I said, I started paying my bills. I was about to buy this house that I was living in. You know, I had custody of my kids. And I just started losing those things rapidly, you know. And fortunately, my first wife had sobered up, and I called her because I couldn't take care of my kids anymore, and I knew it. And, you know, she came and got them, and I stopped paying rent. And I remember there was a period of time where I was just, like, running completely amok. Olympia, Washington, which is kind of where I grew up, pretty much, and I'm embarrassed to ask for help. There's no way I'm going to go to a shelter. I can't go back to treatment. That didn't work. And, you know, I basically, like, a day in the life of Jerry at that point was I'd run around all day long. I'd come home with some friends at about midnight or later. We'd party until, like, 4:30 or 5. I'd kick everyone out. And I would go get in the closet and shut the door and go to sleep. Now, you might say, why would you get in the closet at your house? Well, at like 7:30, there'd be like a knock on the door, and it would be the sheriff's department, and I would just hide. I have no idea to this day what they were looking for me for, but I just didn't want to know. Oh, and the other thing is all the power was turned off, the gas, and I would have to turn those back on at night. And so I just ran away. And I went to Portland, Oregon, because they had a free detox. Someone told me about it. I'm always, you know, it's funny. I get sober, and people say you need a sponsor, and I'm like, I don't need to ask other people questions. But when I was drinking and doing other things, I asked all the questions. Like, I got advice from everyone and chose what I wanted to do. But, so I went to Portland, and that didn't work out, and, I ended up, like, I started working for a carnival for a while, and that didn't work. And, you know, I had this, like, you know, Mexican business partner, and we got into a fight one time. Like, we decided we're going to part ways, and I had seen him, like, do really bad things to people, so I was kind of scared of the guy. And I was like, all right, and we split everything up, and I got on the bus to go down through the city, and I'm riding along, and I look over and I see this big gray thing running around in the parking lot at the Rose Club, which is where the Trailblazers play. And it was a hippopotamus. So I, like, reached up and pulled the little thing, you know, to get off the bus. Because if you see a hippopotamus running around in Portland, Oregon, or anywhere, you should go look, I think. Personally, that's a personal opinion. So I go over there, and there's, like, this security guard, and he says, are you looking for the trailer where they're hiring? He's like, okay. Right? And so I joined the circus that day. And the next day, I moved onto a train with 400, you know, other people. It was like a mile long, and started traveling around. And what that did, you know, like I said, I like to run away. I always want to run away. And I left everything behind. I had, like, I collected a grouping of felonies there in Portland, Oregon, that I wanted to get away from, and all kinds of stuff, you know. Any time I would sober up, like, I feel horrible. Like, I left my kids, you know, no one knows where I am, all these things. And I just got on the train and left, and, you know, I ended up screwing screwing that up like I screw everything up, and getting into Washington, D.C., you know, because the guy that, well, we used to go get people things in other cities, because I have no sense of self-preservation, so I'll go find the ghetto and get people whatever they want, you know, without regard for myself. I don't care. And, you know, we had done that, and we would often just, like, take their money and not come back for a few days. And, like, the third time, it's like, this is going to be bad if we go back. I don't want to go back. And so we decided to go where he was from, which was D.C. And I moved into a neighborhood there where, when I would go out at night, they would call me the white guy. Like, or Chuck Norris, one or the other. And it was just, like, all the time. And I didn't care. Like, I just ran around and stuff, and I got in trouble there. I had borrowed someone's car, and I, like, leased the car to someone, and then I sold it to someone else. And then everyone was there to get the car, but I didn't know where the car was, and the guy who owned the car was there. It was really bad, and, like, there was, people were going to get weapons and stuff, and I just started running. And I ended up, you know, it was February. I ended up at the homeless shelter in D.C. a couple days later, and there was these guys that were like, why are you here? You know, again, I'm the only white person there. And they're like, we're going into this treatment center. Why don't you, you know, see if you can get in with us? And I did. And I was like, because my thought is, I just need to clean up again. If I get like 90 days, maybe I can come. I was thinking I would come here to Florida somewhere. It was warm, right? And if you have to stay outside, it's okay. It's not so bad. So I went into this treatment center. And to get in there, you had to go to 21 meetings in 7 days. That's how you got in. Didn't cost anything. And they knew, like, all the secretaries around the city. They knew if you forged the meetings, which I could never figure out. But I got in there, and I stayed there for a while. And I remember at, like, 90 days, I was thinking, I just had this moment of clarity. Like, I've never really tried to stay AA stuff. And so I thought I would. And I asked this guy to sponsor me because he was weird, and I met him in D.C. I heard him speak in a meeting, and he, like, talked about growing up in Tenino, Washington, which was, like, this little dinky town, this little dinky town where my family's farm was, which was just really weird to me. Plus, he was really funny. He had, like, one arm that had been severed and one leg, and he would, like, take off his leg and scratch his back while he was sharing during meetings. It was hilarious. It was really funny. And so I asked him to sponsor me. And he just stopped dead in his tracks and was like, I take this really seriously. Like, there's no jokes. And he's like, here's the pamphlet on sponsorship. Read that and call me and we'll talk. And I did, and I started doing all the things he said. And I tried to surrender the best I could. And I think I did the best I could at that point. You know, I'd been living for years on self-will, and I had no idea, you know, the things that we talk about in meetings, selfishness, things like that, feelings, I had no idea what they were. I thought, you know, I either felt hungry or I was really pissed off, and that was about it. You know, I didn't have much else for emotions. And he started taking me through the steps, and I remember, like, little tidbits, like, we read, like, the second step, and he's like, do you think you're really an alcoholic? And then he looked at me and goes, not. I was like, what? He's like, I can't help you if you're not. There's nothing I can do for you. And I was like, whoa. And I did a four-step with him, which was the narrative of how the world has wronged Jerry. It was very long. It took me like 7 hours to read. He had just had surgery on his back, so he just had to lay there and listen. He couldn't get away. Poor guy. And he was trying not to take pain medication, so having me around rambling seemed to help him. And you know, I was as honest as I could be, and I, you know, I did what I could at that point. And he moved away. He had to go to Europe for work. And I just started getting this idea that I was going to go home. I'm going to go back to Washington. And I got, you know, some help, some legal help to set everything up, and I had this plan go back to Washington State, and there was no way I was ever going to drink or use again, and I was sure of it, and I would tell anyone, I would argue with people, I'd get so angry if someone said, are you sure that's a good idea? And I went, and I went to Portland, Oregon early in the morning, and I was on the train, and I was by myself, and I hadn't been to a meeting in a few days for the first time ever, and I was a year and a half sober, completely 100% physically separated from any mood-altering substance. And on the way into the city, like, my mind just changed, and, you know, I didn't make it to my court date. I was, like, 3 days late. I just ended up in a hotel, and I'm drinking, and I'm using, and I'm doing all this other stuff, and finally I get to court. I got off because I had all this paperwork. I'd done all the requirements. The judge was like, if he would have found you, you know, you'd be going to prison for 7 years. But it seems how you're obviously sober and you've gone through all this treatment. So I had all these letters and stuff. And I wasn't sober at the time. And the attorney that I had there, he's like, you need to go back into treatment. Like, he knew right away. And I was like, and I just couldn't stop after that. I could not stop. And again, it was just like my mind had changed. Like, I didn't understand it. And a couple years more of running around the West Coast, living all over, I went to San Francisco. I got sobered up there. The state of California agreed to, you know, give me a plane ticket to leave and not come back. And I went to Washington, D.C. I went to the same treatment center. I did the same thing. I stayed in that treatment center for a year and a half. I got a sponsor. I got the same job. I went to the same meetings. I moved out. 2 months later, you know, my daughter's coming to live with me and stuff. And at one day, you know, I'm at work. I'm cooking in this restaurant. And it's been, you know, it's been a good Friday. My specials are doing really well. Everything's going well. And I'm just a little stressed out after work. And finish earlier than I think, and I'm leaving, and I just thought, I should have a cup of port wine real quick. And I walked back in the kitchen, and I poured myself a 16-ounce cup of port wine, which I'd never drank port wine before that. But I downed it, and I started to walk out, and I went back, and I was like, and I poured another one, and I downed it, and then I just never went back to that job. And then I started going to psych ward, you know, because I couldn't stop drinking. And, you know, my poor daughter would take care of me. It was like 2 years of that. I lived in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Fortunately, across the street from the psych ward that I would usually end up in. You know, I became a regular there. I would show up there. They'd be like, I remember the last time I was there, the doctor walked in and he looked at me and he just turned around and walked out. He didn't say anything. And I was just like, dude, you're supposed to help me. And, you know, I just could not stop drinking. And, that's where I met Chris. Chris brought people there. You know, they brought meetings in. And I'd been in there many times. I'd been to the meetings in there. But something, you know, I think it was the day before I met Chris or the day after. I don't know. But something had broke inside of me. Like, it was the middle of the night. I was in between, like, seizures because I was having seizures, having PTs. There was little elephants and some nymphs running around the top of the ceiling. That might have been what they were from the surface. I don't know. And, you know, I was just like, what? Like, I can't go on like this. It's got to stop. Like, just make it stop. I'm too scared to jump off the bridge, because I thought about jumping off the bridge before I went in there. And the only reason I went in there is, like, you know, I'd been drinking in and out of consciousness for several days, and at one point the phone rang, and I answered it, and it was my daughter, and she's just, like, she's yelling at me, she's crying. I want to have a dad, you're going to die, you know, somebody has to, you know, walk me down the aisle someday, and all these things, and I was like, all right, I'll try it one more time, and I didn't think it would work, you know, and so they brought the meeting in, and I remember, like, afterwards, I don't know what I said, but I think I pretty much told them that it hadn't worked for me, and I was afraid it wouldn't, and they all gave me their numbers, and they were like, call before you get out. And I actually did. I called every number on there. And Chris called me back. Got the nurses to come and find me. And we started talking. And I remember it's probably the only time I've, like, you know, like, full-on, phlegm-flying cried and talking to him. And, you know, he listened to me. And we talked. And I was afraid to go home. I live across the street. And I was afraid if I left and went home, there'd be something in my house, and I would use it. Because I tried that, like, a few weeks before when they let me out. I was going to go to a meeting the next day, and I just couldn't make it. And he was like, well, why don't you stay there? And I was like, that's a dumb idea. I didn't say that out loud, but I thought it. I'm like, that's stupid. I live across the street, but I was like, okay. And I started listening, you know, and he came and picked me up. And we went to eat dinner before the meeting, you know, and like he talked about, you know, we come from a home group where people do this stuff and they do it all the time. And, you know, he took me to this restaurant and we're talking and I'm telling him like maybe it was the medication, maybe it was the fact that I started to surrender. But I was telling him the truth for the first time ever. Like, I'm terrified about the money I owe. I'm terrified I'll never be able to like make this shit up to my kids. Never be able to repair this stuff. And, you know, there was a guy at dinner that he's like, tell Craig about your money. And I was like, so I'm like, I'm all tore up about it. I owe like $80,000, $90,000, I don't even know. And I'm just terrified of it. And he starts laughing. He's like, well, I owe like $850,000 and I pay the government $25 every month. And I was like, but his point was, like, he does his part and he feels okay, you know, and I started listening to this stuff. And, you know, I lived in an apartment. I hadn't paid the rent in a long time, like 5 months, I think. And I was, you know, I was scared when I went home. I'm worried that there's going to be, like, an eviction notice on the door or that, like, I'm going to run into the landlord or the manager. And Chris was like, well, why don't you walk up to the payphone? Because my phone was shut off. And my cell phone didn't work, you know, everything was, like, on the edge. And he's like, why don't you walk up to the payphone and call him and tell him what's going on? And I picked up my idea. You know, I don't want to do that, right? But I did it. And he was like, okay, well, I'll give you till the end of this month and, you know, try to get out and, you know, you owe me this money. And I was like, okay. And, you know, my thought was, like, why don't we get some of your friends after the meeting, maybe on Friday or Saturday. We'll go hang out for a while, and then we'll all go to my house at like midnight, and we'll move everything out, right? Maybe we'll take the appliances, because I can sell those to get a down payment for a new place. That's Jerry's idea, right? Chris was like, no, go call him. Tell him the truth. And I did, you know, and I couldn't work. I ended up moving into Chris's basement for a while, you know. I just liquidated everything I had in my life to, like, buy cigarettes and eat, basically. And, you know, I cleaned up around the house to do my part. Everyone was big on you got to pull your own weight. There's nothing for free. Because every time I would sober up, I would go to some treatment center or some social services program, and they take care of you. And then you can resent them because they don't take care of you good enough. But I deserve more food stamps than that. You know, I can only sell those for half price, you know. That's the way I think. And it wasn't that way. And I remember our home group's pretty big, as Chris mentioned. I had lived in my apartment for 2 years. I didn't know anyone around. I just knew the people I worked with and stuff like that. And, you know, I got out on Friday. We went to our home group on Sunday. And Chris, like, stopped me at the greeting line. He was like, stand here. This is where you say hi. My name's Jay. I'm new. Welcome to this one. In like 300 and some people came, and I had to do that with each and every person. And I don't think I talked to that many people in 2 years, honestly, like individually. Like in 2 years, that the total was less than that night, you know. And I started, and then after the meeting, very uncomfortable time if you're very new, you know, where do you go, what do you do, where do you put your hands? And Chris was like, come on, we dry the coffee pots, and we went. And every meeting was like that. I had something to do there, you know, and before and after. And it bought me enough time that I, like, started to feel like I belong. And I started to feel like, you know, this is my meeting, too, over time. And I'd done a lot of the steps before. I'd gotten up the 8th and 9th steps, and I tried to do them of my own volition, without a God, without any, a sponsor often. Never worked out. And, you know, Chris and I had a lot of talks, none of which were comfortable for me. He would say things that I felt were really, really mean, like, oh, if you know so much, old man, why are you here? I'd be like, but it's true. And we started going through the steps right away, and you know, I did a fourth and fifth step at the end. And the difference with this fourth and fifth step was that there was a couple of things that I'd never told anyone, and I wasn't going to, because, you know, I don't like the fact that, you know, that it had happened, and I was terrified about that. And one day, like, we were riding in the car, I'm still writing my fourth step, and I just told him, because I didn't care anymore. I just wanted to not drink anymore. I wanted to feel better. And then, you know, we did my fifth step, and it was not that big of a deal. It just showed me that I'm really, you know, not a nice person. I'm not, you know, someone who just accidentally drank too much and ended up in AA. I'm kind of like, you know, a tornado running through people's lives. And I did an eighth step, like, and I read a lot about the eighth step. And in the 12 and 12, in the preface, the last line in the eighth step says, "This is the beginning of the end of isolation." And, you know, that, like, kind of choked me up, because I knew enough of, you know, like, that was my problem. I couldn't be part of this world. I always kept everyone separate. Like, I could be on a team and no one would know what for a long period of time. Like, I worked with people in kitchens intensely in close quarters, but they never knew anything about me away from work. Or what they did know was only little bits and pieces, because I kept everything compartmentalized. You know, I'm dad, I'm a college student, I'm a guy who goes out and, you know, makes drugs all night. But no one ever knew the whole picture. And, you know, my eighth step was very painful for me. It was horrific to look at all that stuff. And then, you know, I went over it with Chris, and I started doing the things on there. And, you know, those are the things that have changed me more than anything else. I, you know, some things I had to do right away. I had felony warrants in the state of Washington. And they're not going to extradite me for that, but I got this job working in a federal building, cooking, you know, because it's the only place I can find to cook where they don't have booze. And it's going pretty well. And, you know, 90 days, they want to hire me on permanent. They're going to give me an okay little salary. This is going to be good. I can live in my sober house. And in about 89 days, the security come, and they're like, "You got to leave right now." I'm like, "Why?" And they're like, "Well, your name comes up. You have active warrants. You cannot be in a federal facility. You got to go." And I'm just like, "What the?" Right? And so I called Chris, complaining about our government. And you know, so I had to start taking care of that. I had to call all the courts and tell them where I were. I had to call the people that I owed money to and tell them where I was. And I had to go back to Washington State and turn myself in, and, you know, see my family again. I hadn't seen my dad in about 10 years. And the last time I talked to him before I got sober that time, he said, "Don't ever call me again. If you ever get yourself together, you can write, but don't call me, because I can't take, you know, what you do to me." Just, you know, like, I build up hope, and then I just crush it. And, you know, I'm 40 years old. It's not like I'm a little kid. Like, I'll tell you one thing. Being 40 years old in young people group is kind of hard when some 16-year-old kid says, because he has more time than you. But, you know, I started, I got a little lost. I started writing letters to my dad before I went back there, and I wrote letters. I write one every month. And it was several months. I never heard anything back, and that, for me, is not cool. If I can talk to you and watch your face, I'm manipulative enough, I feel a little confident, so I can let go. I'm okay with that, but if I can't see your reaction, and I'm just, like, laying myself out there, it's really that's the way letters are. And finally, one day, you know, my phone rang, and it was my dad. And the other thing is, I just answer my phone when it rang at that point, because I'd called all those predators, and I wasn't like, I don't screen my calls anymore. And, you know, it was my dad, and I talked to him for a while, and, you know, we started talking regularly. And then when I went out there, you know, we met, you know, in a neutral place. And Chris came with me out there, which was really cool. And I'd never went home and stayed sober. I'd went home many times from many different places with various senses, with a sobriety and never been able to stay sober. And, you know, I went and I took care of everything and stayed sober, and I met with my dad, and I got to see some of my other family. And, you know, I got to start working on repairing those relationships. I started showing up regularly. You know, after that, I started going to see my dad like 3 times a year. I'd fly out there. And I did that for years, and I've tried to make amends to my dad, direct amends a few times, and he's like, no. He's like, you keep showing up, keep doing things, we'll be all right. And when I had like 7, 8 years, he took me to the little airport in the town he lives in, and we're sitting there, and he's like, you know, I feel like it's going to be all right. I don't worry about you anymore. I think you've learned lessons that I've been trying to teach you since you were like a little boy. You know, you've learned, you know. That it's hard to even put into words what that felt like, because I was sure I didn't need a dad anymore. I was like, you know, F that guy. I'm never gonna like go back there. And I'm not gonna like talk to my sister anymore. And, you know, I would just never need that. And I started doing all that stuff, and it turns out that like it's hugely valuable to me as a person. And it helped make me whole. You know, these amends have started to, you know, take hold. I mean, a lot of them took like many years. Like, it makes it so I'm able to be present, like in the moment, you know. Like, I can stand here and talk. In high school, grade school, 8th grade, I was supposed to do a book report. I, like, got out of the car, you know, because my mom would drop me off at school, and I waited, and I went into the woods, and I didn't go to school. I'm not going to stand in front of people and talk. It's a terrible thing. You know, and the fact that I'm able to stand up here and do this stuff, it's a result of, you know, being open and you know, like I learned to conquer my fears by making amends. I pray my ass off, and I hope that things work out better than I think they could. And generally, it always does. I had that incident with my dad at the airport, and then every year when I go back, you know, our relationship is a little better, you know. I'm able to, like, you know, he talks to me about what's going on in his life, and I just tell him about my life, and it's awesome, you know. I have 2 brothers and a sister, and I see them fairly regularly, and, you know, I've made direct amends with them. My oldest brother, I remember he was dropping me off at the airport when I had like 5 years, and I put that guy through hell. He was like the executor of my mom's estate, and I was always trying to get, you know, I was on it hard, and I was always trying to get my money from him and stuff, and, you know, he was terrified that it was going to kill me. And I remember he left and dropped me off at the airport, and he's like, you know, this is the first time I'm not worried about you. Like, it's not like, oh God, what's going to happen to Jerry when he leaves? And little things like that, you know. And I've been able to, like, I have 3 kids, and I was able to make amends to them all. And then to make amends again to some of them, because I'm not perfect. I think, you know, sometimes I think that I've learned my lesson, and I'm not such a jerk, and then I am such a jerk to the people really close to me. And I'm like, I got to get that. Right? Awful. See, I'm still like this. You know, and I've been coming to AA since 1987, and I know, like, that people say, you know, you're never going to get better. You'll never get over this. It'll always be a progress. But in the back of my mind, I've always thought that I'm going to get better, that I will get to a point where I don't have to, like, you know, I won't be defective. And in the last couple of years, I found that that's just so untrue. No, I am still defective, even more so, and I get more scared about drinking now than I ever did before as time goes on. It's more terrifying to me to see people that go back, you know. For some reason, through coincidence and, you know, me being willing, I've gotten called to go to the hospital and see people several times in the last couple of years. People that are like, you know, they're there, they've been drinking for years, you know, in full liver failure or something, and they decide they want to have meetings. And I got the chance to talk with these people over time, and I remember there was this one guy, Michael, and he was 32 years old, you know, and he's got a little boy and all. kind of in and out of it for a while, and I went there one time, and no one showed up to go with me, but it just worked out perfectly that I got there, and he was, like, coherent, and we got to talk for, like, we watched, it was the year the Ravens won the Super Bowl, and we got to watch the Ravens beat Pittsburgh or someone before that, and, you know, I just got to talk to him about his life and stuff the whole time, and, like, help him out when he died, like, the next morning. But, you know, he said to me, he's like, "You're so lucky," because I'll never have these chances, but you need to keep doing this, and he, it was so true, and I have no idea, like, with me, personally, I feel like life is never quite enough. I always feel that way. Like, I should make a little more money. I should be a little more successful. I should have this. I should do that. You know? And the reality is, life is really good as it is right now. And I just don't know it. You know? And if you're coming back, I totally get those. Because both of them, I came back a lot. And, you know, my message to you is keep coming back. But more importantly, try and stay here. Don't leave, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to make it back. And, you know, people can say, you know, that always seems cliche to me. Like, whatever, you know. Like, no one ever... I remember having the doctor in the psych ward, you know, like, one arm's kind of strapped down. He comes in to examine me, and he's hitting me in the liver, which really, really hurt, because it was, like, all sticking out. And he's like, "You're gonna die." And I was like, "I'll be fine. I just need to, whatever that is, you know, get out of here and get back to work. Get back with my wife, get back to my kids. There's always something that needs to be more important." And what I learned, you know, when I got sober, I've listened to my sponsor and the other men in our home group, and, you know, most important thing to me is AA. It comes first. And through that, like, everything else in my life has gotten, you know, really good. Well, no, that's not true. Everything in my life is really good. But things have gotten exceptional. You know, they're so much better. Like, I work and it's fine. Work isn't my priority. You know, I try to make AA my priority. I try to hang out with the guys I sponsor more than, you know, or regularly. I try to show up. I always have service at my home group. And, you know, it's been an adventure. And it continues to be. And I don't want that to ever stop for me. And, you know, like I said, if you're new, keep coming. You know, listen to people. Open your mind, you know, and see what happens. That's